Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
Big news! The sale of the season is here. It's Wayfair's Black Friday sale, and it's on now. Right now, get up to 80% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. And with amazing doorbuster deals from November 27th through December 2nd, you can shop the things you love at even lower prices at Wayfair. Plus, you can sit back and relax with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping. Everything home comes straight to your home. And the best part? Free delivery just in time for the holidays. This Black Friday, Wayfair deals are bigger and better than ever. There's no place like home for the holidays. And no place like Wayfair for Black Friday savings. So don't wait. Black Friday ends soon. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now and save up to 80% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. And before we get into today's episode, I am so excited to announce that my first book, Wicked Women, is coming out on May 31st. Now, this book is a collection of 11 stories of true crimes that were committed by women. I detail their lives before the crimes themselves, and then, of course, the impact that the crimes have made. So if you're interested in a signed copy, you can place your order on mamamystery.com/shop before May 31st, and I will be sure to include a signed message inside. So without further ado, let's get into today's story. On the morning of June 4th, 2010, Skyline Elementary School in Portland, Oregon, buzzed with excitement. 7-year-old Kyren Horman proudly posed in front of his red-eyed tree frog science project, grinning in his black CSI t-shirt emblazoned with a green CSI logo and a neon green handprint. His stepmother, Terry Moulton Horman, snapped a photo of the adorable second grader, a photo that would soon become hauntingly famous. It was the last known image of Kyren, taken just before he vanished without a trace inside his own school. By that afternoon, a routine school day had transformed into every parent's nightmare. Kyren never came home, and a frantic search was underway. Kyren's disappearance shook Portland and soon drew national attention. How could a child disappear during a school science fair in broad daylight on school grounds? Over the days and years that followed, the case of Kyren Horman became one of the most perplexing and debated mysteries in Oregon's history. Complete with family drama, failed polygraphs, a rumored murder-for-hire plot, and relentless public speculation. Before we get into exactly what happened that day, I want to get to know Kyren and his family. So, Kyren Richard Horman was born September 9th, 2002, to Desiree Young and Kane Horman. His parents had divorced before he was born. Desiree was 8 months pregnant when they split, citing irreconcilable differences. Initially, they shared custody of baby Kyren, but in 2004, Desiree was tragically diagnosed with severe kidney failure, requiring extensive medical treatment. While Desiree focused on her health, Kyren's father, Kane, an Intel engineer in Portland, assumed full custody, though Desiree remained very much involved in Kyren's life. By all accounts, the Hormans worked to co-parent amicably despite their divorce, and friends later described their extended family as close and supportive, bound together by love for this little boy. But life took a turn in 2007 when Kane remarried. He had begun dating Terry Moulton, a former elementary school teacher from Roseburg, Oregon, around 2001, while he and Desiree were in the process of divorcing. Terry was nearly 12 years older than Kane and came into the marriage with her own past. She had been married and divorced twice before and even had a teenage son from a previous relationship. Those who knew Terry described her as an outgoing, fitness-oriented woman. She held a master's degree in education and worked as a substitute teacher. Interestingly, Terry and Kane married in a Hawaiian ceremony in 2007, and not long after, they welcomed a baby daughter together, Kiara, who was born in December of 2008. With Kyren from Kane's first marriage and Kiara, their baby, Kane and Terry were juggling a blended family. Now, for a while, things seemed normal. Young Kyren lived primarily with his dad and stepmom in a rural Northwest Portland home, but he also spent time with his mom, Desiree, who by then had remarried a Medford police detective named Tony Young. Kyren was a curious, friendly 7-year-old boy who loved science and the outdoors. In pictures, he's kind of a little guy, just 3'8", about 50 pounds, with brown hair, blue eyes, and a big gap-toothed smile. He wore metal-framed glasses, which along with the V-shaped strawberry birthmark on his forehead made him easily recognizable. By second grade, Kyren was known as a sweet kid who loved school, especially science. He'd been excited for the school science fair, where he got to show off a project on his favorite species of frog, the tree frog. But beneath the family's cheerful exterior, tensions were quietly brewing. Desiree would later admit that she had reservations about Terry early on, and in hindsight, certain clues stand out. For example, in early 2010, Terry's teenage son from her previous marriage abruptly moved out of the Horman home and went to live with his grandparents for unclear reasons, but of course, this could be a sign, a possible sign of household strain. Terry was also reportedly struggling after baby Kiara's birth. Friends and even Kane later wondered if Terry had been dealing with postpartum depression or resentment after having her baby. Kane would say that Terry changed dramatically after having the baby, suggesting that she might have been overwhelmed or unhappy. But these bits of context, like a stressed stepmom, a family in despair, would take on new significance once Kyren went missing. At the time, however, no one around Kyren could have imagined what was about to happen. The morning of Friday, June 4th, 2010, seemed like any other, with an added dash of excitement, because that day, Skyline Elementary School was hosting a science fair before regular classes. Terry Horman drove Kyren to school, along with Kiara, who was then 19 months old, arriving early so that Kyren could present his project on red-eyed tree frogs. The school was unusually open to visitors that morning, families milling about the halls, admiring the students' projects. In fact, because of the event, visitors did not have to sign in at the front office, which is an unusual relaxation of security that meant essentially anyone could come and go. Kyren's project board, decorated with pictures of vibrantly colored frogs, was set up in the school hallway near his classroom. Terry stayed with Kyren, proudly watching him show off his work to his friends and teachers. She even took that now infamous photo of Kyren in front of his project, beaming in that CSI shirt. Everything seemed perfectly normal, but shortly before 9 a.m., as the science fair wrapped up, the timeline becomes critical. According to Terry, she last saw Kyren at around 8:45 a.m., walking down the hallway toward his classroom, after they'd visited some of the other exhibits. The second grade classrooms were about to start their day, and Terry later told police that Kyren had mentioned wanting to go see a cool electric project in a different classroom, but she left assuming he would go to his homeroom afterwards. At approximately 8:45, Terry walked out of Skyline School with her toddler daughter in tow and watched Kyren head off towards class, or so she said. No one realized it at the time, but Kyren Horman was never seen again after that moment. He did not show up to his first class, and he was marked absent by the teacher, who assumed, tragically and erroneously, that Kyren had left school with his stepmom due to the morning event. What happened in the hours between 9 a.m. and 3:30 on June 4th would become the subject of exhaustive investigation and endless speculation. Terry's account of her own whereabouts that day is detailed but has been scrutinized heavily. So here's a brief timeline of the critical window when Kyren went missing, according to Terry Horman's statements and investigators' findings. So at 8:45 that day, Terry Horman says she last saw Kyren walking toward his classroom after the science fair, but Kyren never arrives to class and is marked absent. Between 9 and 10 a.m., after leaving Skyline School, Terry runs errands at two Fred Meyer grocery stores in town. She later told police that she was shopping for miscellaneous items while Kyren would have been starting school. At approximately 10:10 a.m., Terry finishes at the second Fred Meyer grocery store. She then spends the next hour and a half driving her toddler daughter around rural roads. Terry claims that Kiara had an earache and the motion of the vehicle was intended to soothe her, but this wandering drive with no fixed destination struck many as unusual. However, if you're a mom, you know that car naps are a thing. And sometimes if that's the only way you can get your toddler to nap, then yeah, driving around aimlessly is what you will do. So I don't find that tidbit to be that weird. But Terry's cell phone records show her on the move until about 11:39 a.m. when she arrives at her next stop. So between 11:39 and 12:40, Terry checks into a local gym, a 24-hour fitness in Beaverton, and spends about an hour exercising. The gym's childcare watched Kiara during this time, and some reports later noted that Terry was a regular at the gym, and this visit was a part of her normal routine. But in hindsight, investigators wondered if it was an alibi move. At approximately 1 p.m., while she was at the gym, Terry is contacted on her cell phone by the school. In a later interview, Terry mentioned that Skyline staff called to ask if Kyren had a doctor's appointment that day, since he hadn't been seen in class. Terry told them no, implying that she was unaware that he was missing at that time. This call has never been officially confirmed by police, but it is part of Terry's story. At 1:21 p.m., Terry leaves the gym and arrives home. At exactly 1:21 p.m., she uploads several photos of Kyren at the science fair to Facebook. Yes, while Kyren was unaccounted for, and she knows this because she got a phone call from the school, Terry was posting his smiling photos online. And some found this odd. Why wasn't she out looking for him if she realized that he wasn't at school? But Terry later said that she still assumed Kyren was safely at school at this point, which makes no sense. But at 3:30 p.m., Terry and Kane Horman, who had returned home early from work, took a walk together with baby Kiara to meet Kyren's school bus at the stop by their rural house. The bus pulls up, but Kyren is not on it. The bus driver informs them that Kyren hadn't boarded the bus at all. Confused and alarmed, Terry calls Skyline's front office on the spot, saying, "Is Kyren there?" The secretary tells her Kyren has been marked absent all day. And in that instant, Terry and Kane realize something is very wrong. Kyren is missing. But again, Terry got that phone call earlier in the day, so why is this that surprising? At 3:46 p.m., within minutes, the school secretary dials 911 to report Kyren Horman as missing from the school. The date, June 4th, 2010, and the time, roughly 3:45 p.m., marked the beginning of what would become the largest search and investigation in Oregon's history. I do want to note that some timeline details are based on Terry Horman's statements, which cannot be independently verified. Law enforcement has not publicly confirmed every exact errand or phone call, but this is the general sequence that Terry provided. Investigators have hinted that certain parts of her story are questionable or unaccounted for, as we will discuss. So as the afternoon of June 4th unfolded, panic set in quickly. Imagine Terry and Kane's dread as the bus pulls up and Kyren isn't on it. A flurry of phone calls ensued. Terry to the school to 911. By 4 p.m., sheriff's deputies and search and rescue teams were racing toward the quiet hills around Skyline Elementary. The school was locked down and scoured, but all the kids are gone at that point. But Kyren Horman had vanished into thin air, and nobody at the school could recall seeing him after about 8:45 a.m. So the mystery had officially begun. Police and volunteer responders descended on the area within hours of Kyren being reported missing. That evening, Multnomah County Sheriff's officers combed through Skyline Elementary, searching every closet, crawl space, and corner of the school for any sign of Kyren. When night fell with no sign of him, the community's worst fears started to set in. An urgent, large-scale search operation was launched that very weekend, and in the coming days, the effort would grow into one of the largest in Oregon history. Search and rescues from across the state and even Washington and California joined in, alongside hundreds of local volunteers. Teams spread out in a two-mile radius around Skyline School, which sits in a wooded, semi-rural area on the edge of Portland's Forest Park. They scoured dense forests, steep hills, and even the brush alongside rural roads. The search quickly expanded to include Sauvie Island, which is a rustic island about 6 miles away from the Willamette River. Investigators never publicly explained what drew them to Sauvie Island, perhaps a tip or some unseen clue, but searchers spent days there, even checking under the Sauvie Island Bridge for clues. So if you picture a map, Skyline Elementary is perched on a high ridge amid thick trees, and Sauvie Island is a short drive north, but lots of remote terrain in between. It was as if Kyren had vanished into the wilderness, but searchers refused to give up. An official with the search later said in defense of the effort, quote, "We had hundreds of trained rescuers on the ground, canine units, dive teams, and nearby bodies of water, you name it." By June 12th, just over a week later, about 300 trained searchers were scouring the woods near the school. Over 10 days, more than 1,300 searchers logged thousands of hours, trudging through mud and brush with no sign of Kyren. Early on, Kyren's family kept a united front in public. In fact, on June 11th, exactly 1 week after he disappeared, Kyren's biological parents, Desiree and Kane, and his step-parents, Terry and Desiree's husband, Tony, all stood together at a press conference. A now eerie scene where Terry Horman stood silently, wearing Kyren's photo on a button, while Desiree and Kane pleaded for their son's return.
That was the day the world came out from under me.
Mom has not given up her search since the then 7-year-old went missing from his elementary school in Portland.
I remember just really struggling to try and think who in the world could possibly do this.
Terry Horman was the last person with Kyren before he vanished from Skyline School 2 years ago.
Though they still aren't calling her a suspect, the investigation is reportedly focused on Terry Horman.
I don't know if we will be able to find Kyren.
By June 9th, just 5 days in, Kyren's family had stopped speaking directly to the media, instead releasing a written statement thanking the public and urging everyone to keep searching. The FBI had been called in by June 10th, bringing specialized agents and even a rapid response child abduction team to aid the local police. Agents and deputies conducted hundreds of interviews with Skyline students, staff, and parents. Every child who had been at the science fair was gently asked, "Did you see Kyren? Do you remember anything strange?" Roadblocks were set up on nearby roads to stop drivers and ask if anyone had seen a small boy or a truck pulled over. But lead after lead went nowhere. There was no evidence of an abduction, no eyewitnesses who saw Kyren leave the school. It was as if he had simply vanished into thin air in a building full of people. 1 week in, on June 14th, Sheriff Dan Staton made a significant announcement saying that Kyren's case was officially transitioning from a missing child search to a criminal investigation. This was an implicit admission that law enforcement suspected foul play. Along with that shift, a $25,000 reward was posted for information leading to Kyren, a figure that would later be increased to $50,000 as the summer wore on. Notably, at that June 14th press conference, Kyren's father, Kane, still publicly defended Terry, who was standing beside him, saying, quote, "I believe she's committed, as the rest of our family is, to finding Kyren," end quote. It would not take long for that unity to crumble, but on that day, outwardly, the Hormans were supporting each other. Meanwhile, the community rallies were incredible. In the first weeks, volunteers printed flyers with Kyren's photo, yellow ribbons were tied around trees, candlelight vigils were organized. One on June 15th drew scores of people holding out hope. Skyline Elementary ended its school year amid the crisis as parents hugged their children a little tighter. It was impossible to imagine a child disappearing from school. Parents in Portland were understandably on edge. The school district beefed up their security and reviewed policies like that informal sign-in free science fair. And after the superintendent called Kyren's disappearance unprecedented and deeply troubling, meanwhile, tips continued to pour in, over 4,200 tips by November of 2010, all tracked and followed by law enforcement at a cost of over $1.4 million in resources. But as the search dragged on with no happy news, a dreadful question crept in. If Kyren was not found in those first critical days, what really happened to him? Increasingly, eyes turned back to the last person who saw Kyren, or at least the last person who admitted to seeing him, Terry Horman. From almost the very beginning, investigators quietly honed in on Kyren's stepmother, Terry. And it's not hard to see why. Terry was the one who brought Kyren to school that day. By her own account, she was the last person to see him. And as the facts developed, Terry's behavior and story seemed at best inconsistent and at worst deceptive. Outwardly, police never named Terry Horman as a suspect or even as a person of interest in Kyren's disappearance, but the subtext was loud and clear. The public first got a hint of this on June 18th when law enforcement distributed a flyer to local residents and asked specifically for information about Terry's activities on June 4th. Essentially, police were quietly verifying Terry's alibi timeline. Around that time, investigators also began administering polygraph tests. Terry Horman sat for two separate lie detector exams regarding Kyren's disappearance, and she failed both of them. In fact, Desiree and Kane later revealed that Terry couldn't or wouldn't pass the polygraphs, even walking out of at least one attempt in frustration. Kane told reporters on July 8th, quote, "Everyone knows that Terry took two polygraph tests. She did not pass those tests," end quote. Desiree added that hearing of those failed lie detectors only confirmed her suspicions that Terry was hiding something. Terry's own later explanation for this was that she has a hearing impairment and couldn't hear the polygraph questions properly, a claim that was met with some understandable skepticism. To Kyren's family, the polygraphs were just one more red flag among many. Even before the polygraph news came out, Terry's behavior raised eyebrows. At first, she played the role of distraught stepmother, attending early pressers, even posting on her Facebook the day after the disappearance, saying that she was hitting the gym to try to cope. But it was a post that many found oddly blasé and like nonchalant given the circumstances, that she's going to the gym today. But as days went by, Terry stopped showing up at search events or public vigils. Reporters who tried to talk to her noticed that she seemed icy and disconnected. One KATU news journalist caught Terry in a grocery store parking lot in early July and gently asked if she had anything to say, but Terry refused to answer and sped off, a moment caught on camera that only fueled public suspicion. Then the case took a stunning turn on June 26th, 3 weeks after Kyren vanished. That day, law enforcement confronted Terry Horman with a bombshell accusation. A man, later identified as the Hormans' landscaper, Rodolfo Sanchez, had come forward alleging that Terry tried to hire him to murder her husband, Kane. In other words, Kyren's stepmom, the last person to see Kyren, was now being accused in a separate plot to kill Kyren's father. This revelation hit the media on June 26th and exploded like wildfire. According to reports, the landscaper said Terry had approached him in January of 2010, 5 months before Kyren disappeared, and offered him a lot of money to kill Kane Horman. Investigators had deemed this credible enough that before confronting Terry, they arranged a sting. They wired up the landscaper and had him meet Terry to ask for $10,000 and essentially say, pay up or I go to the police about your murder for hire request. Terry's response wasn't recorded clearly enough to act on. She didn't incriminate herself, and ultimately she was not charged for this alleged plot, and she vehemently denied it. But just the allegation alone was earth-shattering. It painted Terry as someone potentially capable of deadly schemes, and it obliterated whatever trust Kane Horman still had in her. That same day, June 26th, in the turmoil of that accusation, Terry Horman actually made two 911 calls from the Horman house. The first was described as a threats call, and the second was about custody, suggesting a domestic blow-up between her and Kane. We later learned that what had happened was this. Investigators warned Kane about the murder-for-hire allegations, urging him that he and baby Kiara might be in danger. Kane packed a few things and, taking the 19-month-old with him, abruptly left the house that evening. Terry, suddenly realizing her husband knew of her alleged betrayal, dialed 911, perhaps in a panic over what he might do or to report feeling unsafe. The details are murky, but it's telling that after those calls, Kane never returned home. Instead, on June 28th, Kane Horman filed for divorce and obtained an immediate restraining order to keep Terry away from him and their toddler daughter. In his divorce filings, which became public, Kane stated in no uncertain terms that he believed Terry was involved in Kyron's disappearance and that police had shown him probable cause of Terry's murderous intentions toward him. From that point on, Terry's life was under a microscope. She was now effectively estranged from the family. Kane took Kiara and moved to an undisclosed location. Friends sheltered him for a while, as he feared for his safety, understandably. Desiree, Kyron's mom, was beyond furious. She and Kane began to speak more freely to the media, essentially accusing Terry of heinous wrongdoing. At a press conference on July 8th, Desiree did not mince words about her ex-husband's wife, saying, quote, "It's extremely frustrating that Terry is not cooperating. We implore her to do the right thing. Kyron deserves for us to tell the truth," end quote. Kane also spoke directly addressing Terry through the press, saying, quote, "We're not going away. We're not going to stop. The focus needs to be on Kyron, for Terry to tell the truth and help us find Kyron," end quote. Now, amid this firestorm, Terry lawyered up big time. On June 30th, just 2 days after the divorce filing, Terry retained one of Portland's most prominent criminal defense attorneys, Stephen Howes. Stephen Howes is a high-powered lawyer known for handling intense, high-profile cases. Rumors swirled about how Terry, a stay-at-home mom, could afford his hefty fees. Kane insinuated Terry's parents paid perhaps a $350,000 retainer. In any case, once Howes was on board, Terry went completely silent publicly, as any good attorney would insist. She refused to speak to police any further beyond that initial interview, and all communication was through her lawyer. For investigators, this was really frustrating. For the public, already inclined to see Terry as the villain, it was basically confirming their suspicions. And still, no arrest came. Despite all the smoke around Terry, her odd timeline, the failed polygraphs, a potential motive of marital trouble, even an alleged prior crime for hire, police did not have the proverbial smoking gun to arrest her in Kyron's case. Kyron was still missing, and crucially, there was no physical evidence, there was no crime scene, no DNA, nothing linking Terry to an actual crime. It remained a circumstantial case and a painfully unresolved one. As the summer of 2010 wore on, the Kyron Horman investigation branched out in several intriguing ways. Detectives weren't just looking at Terry, they were also interested in anyone around Terry who might have helped her or known something. This led to a focus of one of Terry's close friends, a woman named Dee Dee Speicher. Now, Dee Dee, who was 43, was a gardening buddy of Terry's and a fellow fitness enthusiast. In fact, Terry and Dee Dee had met years prior at the gym, and Dee Dee was fiercely loyal to Terry. When Kane walked out with Kiara in late June, Dee Dee actually moved into Terry's house for about 11 days to support her friend in crisis mode. The two women reportedly barricaded themselves from the media and tried to cope with the onslaught, reading online updates but avoiding comment sections and TV news, according to Dee Dee. Dee Dee later told People magazine, quote, "She was receiving death threats. We were worried for Terry's life and worried about Kyron, too," end quote. She also said that Terry would sit sadly sifting through Kyron's drawings and family photos, crying and distraught. Dee Dee insisted that Terry was a loving mom who could not have hurt Kyron, saying, quote, "If I thought for a second that she was capable of foul play, I would not have been there. She wouldn't be my friend in the first place," end quote. Now, despite Dee Dee's personal defense of Terry, law enforcement found her involvement concerning enough to subpoena. In late July 2010, a Multnomah County grand jury issued subpoenas for several of Terry's friends, including Dee Dee. Investigators had learned that Dee Dee's own whereabouts on June 4th were potentially suspicious. She was working as a landscaper gardener at a property on Germantown Road, not far from Skyline School that day. And witnesses said that Dee Dee left the property abruptly around the same time Kyron disappeared for about 90 minutes and was unreachable on her cell phone. This gap in her timeline raised a lot of eyebrows. When first questioned, Dee Dee was initially perceived as uncooperative. Kane and Desiree publicly claimed that she was advising Terry on how to evade the investigation and even telling others not to talk to police. Police, however, later stated that Dee Dee did cooperate. She allowed a search of her condo and car and sat through hours of interrogation. Dee Dee maintained she simply took a lunch break during her gardening job and never left the premises that day, disputing the idea that she disappeared during that crucial window. She also admitted that sometime after Kane moved out, she helped Terry purchase a new cell phone under a different name, described as an untraceable burner phone, which certainly looks suspicious. Dee Dee said it was just so that Terry could have some privacy, given her primary phone was likely tapped by police. Regardless, investigators clearly wondered if Dee Dee might have helped Terry in some way on June 4th, whether as a lookout or by holding Kyron somewhere. But no evidence ever emerged to charge Dee Dee with anything. She was not indicted by the grand jury and eventually just drifted out of the spotlight. Another curious figure was Michael Cook, an old high school friend of Kane Horman's who inserted himself into the search effort. Michael Cook, who was 37, attended some early vigils and had even helped organize the candlelight vigil for Kyron. On the surface, he was just a concerned family friend. But in July of 2010, as part of the divorce proceedings, Kane dropped a bombshell. He accused Terry of beginning an extramarital affair with Michael Cook just days after Kyron went missing.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And the epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Now, this shocking allegation was backed by investigation. Detectives had seized Michael's cell phone and found hundreds of text messages between him and Terry, including explicit sexual messages and even inappropriate photos that Terry sent him. So essentially, while the search for Kyron was ongoing and Terry was under suspicion, she was allegedly sexting Kane's friend, Michael Cook. The public could hardly believe it. Could Terry be so cold? One former detective, C.W. Jensen, voiced what many people were thinking, saying, quote, "She engaged in an affair with another man after the kid disappears. Are you kidding me?" End quote. Michael Cook admitted that he had gotten too close to Terry and engaged in inappropriate communication, but he denied actually sleeping with her. He claimed he was drawn in during a vulnerable time, but wouldn't comment further without an attorney. This salacious side story only further villainized Terry in the court of public opinion. She's flirting and sending nude pics to another man who happens to be her husband's friend, while her stepson is missing and her husband is in anguish. It painted a picture of Terry as, frankly, someone with astonishingly poor judgment at best and a depraved heart at worst. If that weren't enough, Kane's July 12th court filings also accused Terry of a truly desperate act, attempting to abduct baby Kiara from the gym daycare 2 weeks after Kyren disappeared. According to Kane, on June 26th, the same day the murder-for-hire plot came out, Terry went to the 24-hour fitness gym daycare while Kane was exercising there and tried to remove Kiara, violating the existing informal arrangement and perhaps intending to take off with her. The gym staff, aware of the family situation, prevented Terry from taking the child. This incident, described in Kane's filings as Terry, quote, looking to abduct her daughter, prompted Kane to get the formal restraining order immediately. Terry subsequently lost visitation and custody of Kiara, and she eventually agreed to give up even supervised visitation rights to avoid criminal charges related to that attempt. It was an almost unthinkable drama unfolding concurrently with the search for Kyren. Throughout July of 2010, these swirling revelations, the alleged murder plot, the failed Polly's, the friend Dee Dee under scrutiny, the sexting affair, the attempted abduction of Kiara, like it's all so much, but it all created, naturally, a media frenzy. And still, Terry Horman said nothing publicly. She couldn't. She was essentially in legal lockdown via her attorney. Her father did speak out at one point, telling a reporter that Terry was trying to be as cooperative as she could, saying, quote, I guess the police think she's going to break, end quote. Now, indeed, there was a sense that investigators were turning up the heat in hopes that Terry would crack and confess or divulge Kyren's whereabouts. They even convened a grand jury to hear evidence, summoning not just friends like Dee Dee, but also Kane, Desiree, and even the principal of Skyline School to testify in August of 2010. However, by December of that year, the Oregonian reported the grand jury hadn't returned any indictments. The DA simply did not have enough to charge anyone, and the case was going cold, at least publicly. One investigative tidbit that came out in August was that law enforcement announced they were looking for an unidentified second person who may have been seen in or near Terry's truck on June 4th at Skyline School. Two witnesses thought they recalled seeing Terry in the school parking lot that morning with another adult in the truck. To this day, that lead remains unsolved. No such person has been identified or come forward. And the identity of that person, if he or she existed, could be critical in determining what happened to Kyren after 9 a.m. on June 4th. Now, amid all these allegations, it's important to underscore that Terry Moulton Horman has never been arrested or charged in connection with Kyren's disappearance. She maintains her innocence to this day. And in interviews years later, Terry insisted that she believes Kyren was abducted by a stranger, not harmed by her. For instance, Terry claims that on the morning of June 4th, she saw an unknown man in a white Ford pickup truck parked near a 7-Eleven on Highway 30 acting strangely. She told Dr. Phil in 2016 that this man was pacing and acting very strangely outside the convenience store for about an hour, implying he could have been the kidnapper scouting the school route. Now, critics note that Terry never mentioned the suspicious man to the police at the time, only years later on TV, which, of course, raises doubts. Terry also told Dr. Phil that she does not know where Kyren is, that she's never known, and will always believe that he is alive until someone shows her proof otherwise. She portrayed herself as a mother figure grieving a lost child and unfairly maligned by cops and the media. She said that she stayed silent on advice of law enforcement and her then husband in the early days, and that if she could do it over, she would have spoken up for herself sooner. Now, I want to play a clip from that Dr. Phil episode. It's about 5 minutes long, but I think it is incredibly telling for you to hear Terry speaking in her own words regarding text messages that she was sending Michael Cook and just how quickly she tries to divert the blame.
You're posting on Facebook a few days afterwards with things that some people were critical of. For example, saying, hitting the gym tomorrow. I didn't get home until 8 p.m. tonight. This is 4 days after Kyren has gone missing. Mm-hmm. At this point, you don't know if he has been kidnapped, and is being raped and tortured, is lying dead and cold in a ditch. You don't know what is going on. And you say, hitting the gym tomorrow. I didn't get home until 8 p.m. tonight. That, I think, would be viewed as a lot of people as atypical behavior for a distraught mother of a missing child.
Well, that would be because the law enforcement told us to do things that we normally do. So they want you to go grocery shopping. They want you to go to the gym. They actually specifically told both Kane and I, and he was with me that day when we went.
Did they tell you to sext with someone 26 days afterwards?
No.
Because I found this really strange behavior, and I have to tell you, I have a hard time squaring this up, and I have to say, I took out, there were many of these that I just simply FCC can't put up, and I'm only putting your side up here, but you're texting with a man, and you say, whatever, like I'm going to get any ever again. Tell Jason Statham I'm available for whatever. I can bench, you're talking about bench pressing, I can do 195, that's how I roll. Then you say, you know, you're flirting around, I'm stronger than you. He responds. You say, we need to arm wrestle. Meanwhile, just know I can take you down. I won't hurt you, though. I'll pin you down and sit on you. I take it you're attracted to me. Okay, I didn't want to ravish you or anything. Insert evil grin with latex. Whoops, did I say that out loud? If you didn't have your son tonight, I would show you what I think of you. I may have to clear it with the boss. You talk about hiring this defense lawyer extraordinaire. You're toast, beware. Grin, going to bed, underwear and tank top. Think about that. Do you want a pick? Then you send a photo and say, that's only the left one. I quote unquote aim to please. Did you want something bigger? Another photo. I mean, it gets much more graphic. So this, we're talking not 3 weeks that your son has been missing.
And not 2 weeks into it. This is what Kane's doing with somebody else.
Well, I'm talking about you
I know,
as a mother.
I exactly.
Kane's not here. He's been here. You're here. I'm asking you. You're a mother with a missing child.
This was in retaliation for something that he was doing that I found out about while this was happening. And this particular person was actually his friend and sent to the house. So this was a setup. I'm saying this person came to the house. He was Kane's friend. I did this deliberately because I was angry and getting back at him.
So you text and say, I'll show you what pleasure
is?
I had no
interest in having this person in my life. This was something to screw with Kane because I was angry with him because he was doing the exact same thing with somebody else.
But you apparently are trying to hide it because at one point you say, I can't talk, bugs in the house, in danger if I go outside. I want you so bad. I don't know what it is about you, but I'm very attracted to you. Give me 15 minutes and I will make you moan. And you're saying, I can't do this where anybody can hear me. And you're sending very graphic photos. I mean, we're clinical. Graphic photos near, right? And you're saying this is for revenge?
Yeah, but also by this time, we're not even in together anymore.
From day one, the media played a huge role in the Kyron Horman case. Local Portland outlets provided daily, even hourly coverage for that first summer. National media, network morning shows, CNN, true crime TV series also picked up the story. The ingredients were sadly irresistible. An adorable missing second grader, a photogenic family torn apart, and a mystery with a devious-seeming stepmother at its center. The press, and by extension the public, largely zeroed in on Terry as the villain of the piece. Terry's very appearance was analyzed. Her often stoic or stone-faced expression in photos led one criminal profiler to remark that many saw her as having ice running through her veins and not demonstrating proper emotional responses. That profiler, Pat Brown, bluntly suggested Terry exhibited signs of psychopathy, which are comments that were splashed across a ton of headlines. It was harsh, and again, Terry had not been charged with any crime, but in the court of public opinion, Terry was effectively on trial every day. Desiree Young and Kane Horman both leveraged the media to keep pressure on Terry and to keep Kyron's story alive. Desiree, in particular, became something of a fixture on TV for a time, making tearful pleas on shows like Good Morning America and Dateline, begging Terry to cooperate. In late June of 2010, Desiree and Kane even went on Oprah via satellite and later on ABC's 2020, expressing their fading hope that Kyron would be found safe. Desiree's raw pain was evident. She broke down crying in the interviews, calling Terry a liar and imploring, "Why, Terry, why? Where is Kyron?" The media attention undoubtedly helped keep the case in the spotlight, but it also potentially complicated the investigation, essentially turning Terry into a public pariah overnight. In early July, furious flyers started circulating in Portland with Terry's photo calling her a baby killer. It got so intense that police warned the public not to harass or threaten anyone, even as they themselves were clearly laser-focused on Terry. One interesting aspect was how Terry's own past and personality were dissected by reporters. We learned quirky tidbits like she had been a competitive bodybuilder in her younger years, she loved karaoke, she struggled with weight and mentioned wanting liposuction by age 40 on her Facebook page. She had a pattern of tumultuous relationships. One ex-husband alleged Terry had cheated on him, and indeed, she met Kane through an affair while he was still married to Desiree. Now, none of this means that she committed a crime, of course, but the narrative that formed was of a dissatisfied woman approaching 40, resentful of sacrifices that she'd made for a domestic life. She'd posted on Facebook about giving up her hobbies for her family. And it wasn't hard for armchair profilers to theorize that she might have seen Kyron, a child of Kane's previous marriage, as a burden or obstacle. Some speculate Terry might have harmed Kyron in a twisted attempt to save a failing marriage, that if she viewed Kyron as competing for Kane's attention, or out of anger toward Desiree, or even due to postpartum depression altering her state of mind. These remain theories, but Terry has never wavered from denying involvement. The media also reported on law enforcement's unique strategies to break the case. For example, it came out that investigators had covertly planted an undercover officer inside Kyron's family early on, someone who posed as a supportive friend but was actually observing Terry at close range. This officer was present during some of those initial family press conferences and meetings, watching Terry's demeanor when the cameras were off. Multnomah County Sheriff's Office also took the unusual step of releasing Kyron's missing poster in several different languages and circulating it at truck stops and across state lines in case Kyron had been taken far away. There were a few false alarms. For instance, on June 11th, someone in, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but Eureka, it's Y-R-E-K-A, California, which is hundreds of miles south, reported seeing a boy that looked like Kyron at a restaurant. So local police swarmed, but it turned out to be another child who just resembled him. Each time a possible sighting hit the news, Kyron's family would get a surge of hope, only to have it dashed. Social media, too, became a factor. Facebook groups popped up for Find Kyron Horman, which eventually turned into outlets for theories and finger-pointing at Terry and anyone else who was connected. In 2010, this was still somewhat early in the era of social media-fueled true crime discussion, but in forums like Web Sleuths and on Facebook, thousands of commenters debated every detail. Rumors spread, some claimed with no evidence that Terry had sedated Kyron that morning, or that she hid him in a basement, or that she had handed him off to someone else in a parking lot. Others hypothesized that a stranger could have slipped into the school and lured Kyron out, pointing to that relaxed science fair security. One rumor suggested an old friend of Terry's, not Dee Dee, but another person, had a sexual predator background, thoroughly debunked, but it showed how wild things got online. Now, the family, for the most part, tried to ignore these rumors. Desiree, even at one point, publicly urged people not to spread unfounded theories, as it was hurtful and distracting. But in private, Desiree herself had some theories. She strongly felt Terry might have hurt Kyron in a fit of rage or spite, perhaps even unintentionally, saying, quote, "I believe she did something that day. She still hasn't told us the whole truth of what happened on June 4th. By late 2010, with no resolution, media coverage inevitably died down a bit, but Kyron's case never went fully cold. Periodically, new search efforts were conducted as tips came in. For instance, in January of 2011, the task force got new intel that prompted them to search some dense areas in the West Hills of Portland, near Skyline, with cadaver dogs. Desiree said she'd been briefed on the intelligence and hoped that those searches might bring closure, but sadly, nothing notable was found. In the summer of 2011, there were also searches along rural roads and a tunnel near the school. Each time, hope would flare that this might be it, but Kyron remained missing. Frustrated by the lack of criminal charges, Kyron's mother, Desiree, took an extraordinary legal step 2 years after the disappearance. On June 1st of 2012, Desiree filed a civil lawsuit against Terry Horman, accusing her outright of kidnapping Kyron and seeking $10 million in damages. The goal, Desiree said, was not for money, but information. Through civil discovery, she hoped to finally pry answers from Terry under oath. In her suit, Desiree alleged that Terry was responsible for the disappearance of Kyron, essentially a wrongful abduction claim. Terry's attorneys fought back hard, calling the suit unfounded and an impediment to the ongoing police investigation. For over a year, the civil case bounced through motions. A judge denied Terry's attempt to delay the lawsuit in August of 2012, which was seen as a win for Desiree, but ultimately, in July of 2013, Desiree withdrew the lawsuit. She stated she didn't want to jeopardize the concurrent criminal investigation. Essentially, law enforcement asked her to step back, fearing a civil proceeding could tip Terry off to police strategies or give Terry an opportunity to solidify her story. It was a tough pill for Desiree to swallow. She said later that dropping the suit was one of the hardest decisions, but she still holds out hope for criminal justice. Meanwhile, by the end of 2013, one chapter closed quietly. Kane and Terry's divorce was finalized. Terry had stalled the proceedings for years, but with no contest left, the marriage was dissolved. The restraining order against Terry had kept her from any contact with Kiara during those years, and after the divorce, Terry's supervised visitation rights for Kiara also lapsed. So essentially, Terry has not seen her daughter since 2010. Kane continued to raise Kiara as a single dad. Over the years, Terry Moulton Horman remained mostly in the shadows, but she did pop up in the news due to new legal troubles of her own. In 2016, Terry, who by then had moved to California and was using her maiden name, Terry Moulton, was arrested twice in the space of 6 months. First, in July of 2016, she was arrested in Yuba County, California, and charged with stealing a handgun from her roommate. The roommate alleged that Terry took his firearm. She failed to show up for an initial hearing, leading to a brief jail booking on July 4th. And Terry pled not guilty, and interestingly, by the end of 2016, she was acquitted of the theft charge, either for lack of evidence or jury decision. It's not entirely clear, but she was cleared. Then in December of 2016, Terry was arrested again, this time in Marin County, California, for driving a stolen vehicle. Police outside San Francisco found her in a car that wasn't hers. That charge was later dropped due to insufficient evidence. It appears the car theft couldn't be pinned on her, and it was dismissed. However, around the same time, there were reports of a domestic violence charge involving Terry in California as well, possibly a dispute with a boyfriend or a roommate, because the details are scarce. But these scrapes with the law prompted a new wave of headlines like Terry's Troubles, and Desiree Young publicly commented that this was just Terry's true nature coming out. Desiree said that seeing Terry continue to get into trouble actually gave her hope, saying, quote, "She's going to be held accountable for what she's done, for Kyron and everything else. I hope that's going to come this year," end quote. Desiree even voiced fear that Terry might hurt someone else if she's not stopped, saying, quote, "I think she's a threat to the community. Before she's in prison, she may hurt someone else." In 2016, Terry briefly broke her media silence by appearing on that Dr. Phil episode I shared with you earlier. This was her first on-camera interview about Kyron. On the show, Terry was defensive and at times tearful. She said that she had stayed silent because police and her family told her to in 2010. She denied harming Kyron and repeated her belief that a stranger took him, bringing up the mysterious man at the 7-Eleven again. Dr. Phil pressed her on the failed polygraphs, and Terry claimed that the polygraph examiner was rude and that she couldn't hear the questions properly due to a hearing issue, which many people find that explanation to just be bullshit. But the interview, according to Desiree, didn't reveal any bombshells. In fact, Desiree said that she was frustrated watching it, feeling like Dr. Phil was too soft on her, and that Terry just continued to lie and evade. Still, seeing Terry on national TV again renewed interest in the case for a time. It also coincided with Terry's aforementioned legal problems, almost as if once she stepped back into the spotlight, trouble followed. As of now, Kyren has been missing for 15 years. For Kyren's family and the Portland community, time has not healed this wound. Each year on the anniversary of his disappearance, June 4th, which is coming up, and on Kyren's birthday in September, supporters hold events to honor him and keep his face in the public eye. In fact, Kyren's 18th, 19th, and 20th birthdays passed with still no answers, an agonizing reality for Desiree and Kane. They often wonder what Kyren would be like now as a teenager or young man. Desiree Young has channeled her pain into advocacy. She frequently organizes an annual charity car wash each June in Kyren's honor, raising money that she uses for continuing the search, sometimes hiring private investigators and funding flyers or billboards. In early June of 2024, the 14th anniversary, Desiree helped launch a new Multnomah County Sheriff's Office webpage dedicated to Kyren's case, which makes it easier for the public to submit tips. The sheriff at that time, Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell, reiterated the commitment of the law enforcement, saying, quote, "Kyren's disappearance continues to have a profound impact on his family and our community. Our detectives continue to pursue all legitimate leads and will do so until Kyren is located," end quote. Modern technology is being employed from advanced DNA analysis to geospatial mapping to re-examine every shred of data in this case. The Multnomah County District Attorney, Mike Schmidt, also gave a statement of resolve, saying essentially that they're not giving up and that they are committed to working collaboratively with law enforcement to investigate any new facts or evidence that may surface. As the years pass, age-progressed images of Kyren have been released periodically. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children created an image of what Kyren might look like as a teenager, and in 2022, on what would have been his 20th birthday, another image showing him as a young adult was shared. It's heartbreaking to think Kyren is now a grown man out there if he's still alive, but these images keep hope flickering that someone might recognize him. The official reward for this information stands at $50,000, and the tip lines, both to the sheriff and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is 1-800-THE-LOST, remain open. Over the years, there have been occasional spikes in tips. For instance, after a 2020 special on the ID channel called Real Life Nightmare Vanished from School, a new batch of tips came in, which investigators did follow up. Desiree Young has been unflinchingly clear about her own belief, saying, quote, "It's not a stranger that took Kyren. We know what happened for the most part." That is why Desiree continues to push year after year for that last piece of the puzzle that could finally bring a prosecution. It's as much about finding Kyren or answers about his fate as it is about seeking justice. She said, "I don't want to be here another year with no answers." As for Terry Horman, she reportedly left Oregon to escape the infamy, trying to rebuild her life in California under her maiden name. But even there, as we saw, trouble found her. She has lived a relatively transient life, keeping a low profile. And if you searched her name today, you'd find those arrest reports and not much else. In 2018, there were rumors that Terry was working on a memoir or a book to tell her side, but nothing concrete has emerged. One can imagine she's still recognized occasionally and harassed by those who remember Kyren's case. It's the kind of notoriety that doesn't fade. And honestly, I love that for her. Kyren Horman would be 22 years old this year. A young man, perhaps he'd be in college or starting a career. Maybe he'd still love science and nature as he did when he was 7, catching frogs and learning about the world. That's the heartbreaking part. We can only wonder. A little boy's life was frozen in time on June 4th of 2010. The Skyline Elementary community certainly hasn't forgotten him. Outside the school and at locations around town, people set up memorials and gardens with frog ornaments, pictures, and messages for Kyren. In one spot, a large wall of photos and cards stands as a reminder that this child mattered. Every year on that wall, new notes appear, saying essentially that they will never give up on Kyren. The disappearance of Kyron Horman prompted changes in school safety policies in Portland. Schools tightened their visitor sign-in rules and became more vigilant with attendance reporting. Parents in the community became, by necessity, a bit more paranoid about security at school events. It's an uncomfortable legacy, but one that hopefully keeps other children safe. The disappearance of Kyron Horman remains one of Oregon's most haunting mysteries, but it's not a story anyone has given up on. Until there is resolution, until Kyron is found, the rest of us shouldn't give up either. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Share it, please, to share Kyron's story. Share it to either your social media or with a friend. And if you're not already following the podcast, make sure you subscribe. It's totally free to do that. You can do it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and probably wherever you get your podcasts, but it'll just let you know when there is a new episode or updates on other cases as well. Thank you so much for listening. And until next week, stay vigilant, stay curious. Mama Mystery out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand. Through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.